I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon, the 3rd of December. This hour, we ask, is there a relationship between climate change and violence? Are we correct in calling climate change a security issue? And are there indirect links between climate change and Syria's war? Our guest this hour says that we can't say that climate change caused that civil war, but at best, it might be one factor among many that deserves careful study. We, this hour, are going to be joined by Francesco Femia, who's a co-founder and director of the Center for Climate and Security. Mr. Femia leads the center's policy development, analysis, and research programs, and facilitates the primary forum for climate security dialogue in the United States' national security community. He has written and published extensively on the security implications of climate change, water stress, and natural resource mismanagement in Syria and in North Africa, including the very large report, The Arab Spring and Climate Change. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Francesco. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Francesco, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you here. Let's start right away with Syria. It's a very interesting set of facts here of what has happened to Syria, as you write, from 2007 to 2010. There is especially brutal drought. Can you talk about that drought? What happened to the population? What happened to farmland? And whether or not we can make a link between the civil war and what was happening to the climate?
Yeah, sure. I think in general, when we're looking at how climate change impacts countries, and in this case in Syria, it makes sense to think of it as a brush fire. I mean, in order to have a brush fire, the brush has to be dry. And I think in this case, what happened was from 2007 to 2010, Syria experienced the worst drought in its recorded history. Now that drought, according to a recent study, was made 2 to 3 times more likely because of climate change. That drought was also part of a trend in the region going back to the 70s of a significant increase in winter precipitation decline. So the region is very dry, but it gets most of its water in the winter. But due to climate change, based on a number of studies, the region is getting drier in the winter. And so that drought occurred during that time period. And what happened as a result of that, and also other factors, such as, for example, the Assad regime was subsidizing water-intensive cash crops like cotton, also wheat, which takes up a lot of water. And in agricultural areas, there was widespread use of flood irrigation, where you basically lose or waste about 60% of the water you use. Those things all came together during that time period, and 75% of the most vulnerable farmers in Syria lost their entire
75%.
Crop.
Goodness.
It's a major number of people that basically lost their crop entirely and weren't able to recover that. So those people were displaced. 85% of herders, pastoralists in the country, lost their livestock entirely. So this was a major, major issue. And in total, the most recent numbers we've seen is roughly about 1.5 million people were displaced as a result of those dynamics. And so a number of those people, at least half, based on recent numbers, moved into some urban areas. This all happened before the revolution in Syria, and so it's important for us to not discount the impact that this may have had on discontent within the country. Though, of course, I think, as you said in your introduction, it's hard to sort of put a number on or a percentage on, you know, what, you know, how much climate change contributed to the actual conflict, but it was certainly a contributing factor.
Right. Well, and then you had this incredible political mismanagement. Why would you put, why would you subsidize all these crops that take so much water, like cotton and wheat, when you've got a drought going on?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been a practice of the Assad regime to sort of pride itself, or really the regime prided itself on being more sort of food secure than its neighbors, like Egypt, for example, that is heavily dependent on the global wheat market. So the Assad regime was saying, well, we're going to produce our own wheat, and we're going to provide, you know, bread for our people within the country. So then we'll be less dependent on what was perceived as a volatile global food market. The case there, though, is that it's a, you know, very water stressed area, and then when the drought was added on top of existing water stress, you had a devastating situation. And also, I point to cotton as well. So obviously, a cash crop rather than a food crop, the cotton takes up a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to be careful. I think when we talk about climate change and conflict, to not absolve governments of responsibility, and I think the Assad regime was certainly culpable, and was frankly probably putting its resources in places that were less vital to the security of their population.
Mm-hmm. So, as you've said, you can't say that climate change caused the civil war, but at best it might be, as you've said, one factor among many that deserves careful study.
Yeah, I mean, the way the security community, including for example, the U.S. military and the intelligence community, describes climate change as a threat multiplier. It basically makes other risks to security worse. If it's a dry place, it can make it drier. It can make, you know, rain come when you don't expect it. It can, you know, create severe weather during times that's not expected, et cetera. And that can have an impact on other things that can drive conflict. So it's a contributing factor. It's a threat multiplier. And that means that, you know, it's less important to sort of rank it as was climate change a bigger, you know, factor than other things like political and security, political and economic risks in the country. And more important to look at how does it impact those other things that make instability and conflict more likely. So.
But it sounds like a lot of the people who are looking at this part of the world, as you remind us, before the Syrian civil war broke out, a lot, you write, of security analysts wrongly believe the country as stable and immune from Arab Spring unrest precisely because they were overlooking the effects of the drought.
I think that was one of the reasons. So there's a quote in the recent book, The Obamians, by the Deputy Secretary of State, Jim Steinberg. And he mentioned that after Libya, Tunisia, and Egypt experienced their own political turmoil, the administration drew up a list based on the analysis that they'd gotten from internally. They drew up a list of the countries in the region that were most likely to experience political turmoil. Syria and Saudi Arabia were at the bottom of that list. And, you know, there may be some other sort of dynamics that analysts were missing on the ground, whether they were political or economic. But what's clear is that the way that we as political analysts or as intelligence analysts assess whether or not a country is fragile is a little bit outdated, and it doesn't properly sort of account for some of the natural resource, environmental, and climatic factors that can drive that kind of instability. And I'd also argue that it also doesn't properly account for internal displacement. And I think in this case, some of that culpability is on the Assad regime as well, who is sort of preventing reporters and others from sort of from accessing the people who were being internally displaced and talking to those people. So in some way, there was a lack of information because the government didn't want that information to get out. But in general, the way we analyze these things is a little bit outdated. And I think, though, that the lesson's been learned, and I think in the future, analysts will be much more attuned to these issues than they have been.
What makes you believe that the lesson has been learned?
Well, it's a good question. I think, you know, from what we've heard in our own discussions with both policy policymakers and people in government, not just the U.S. government, but elsewhere, there's a much greater attention than there has been in the past to these kinds of environmental stresses. And so I think we see signs that going forward, they'll just need to be a more robust look at these kinds of issues. Because I think in the past, it's sort of a cultural thing. In the past, we've seen environmental issues as sort of low politics, kind of, often, in this environmental box in the corner that, we'll deal with that, but it's sort of bugs and bunnies. And, it's not a big deal, and it has nothing to do with these bigger issues of national security. But I really think that's changing, and we're also mm-hmm. seeing evidence of that from our political and our military leaders. Mm-hmm. We keep hearing this from leaders in the security community, especially over the past few years, and I think that's pretty significant.
Mm-hmm. And from some presidential candidates, let's hear a moment here, and I'd like your response to what he has to say. The last Democratic presidential debate, the moderator, John Dickerson from CBS, talked about the terrorist attacks in Paris because the debate was happening right after those had happened. And he asked Bernie Sanders if Bernie, in light of those attacks, still believed that climate change was our greatest national security threat. And here's what Senator Bernie Sanders had to say, and I'd like for your response to what he had to say.
Senator Sanders, you said you want to rid the planet of ISIS. In the previous debate, you said the greatest threat to national security was climate change. Do you still believe that?
Absolutely. In fact, climate change is directly related to the growth of terrorism. And if we do not get our act together and listen to what the scientists say, you're going to see countries all over the world. This is what the CIA says. They're going to be struggling over limited amounts of water, limited amounts of land to grow their crops. And you're going to see all kinds of international conflict. But of course, international terrorism is a major issue that we have got to address today.
Francesco, what do you make of those comments?
Sure, yeah, I'd heard that before. What my response is that we need to, there are two things we need to do. We need to both avoid oversimplifying these connections, but also avoid underestimating them. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is in this case, there is certainly evidence from, and we validated by our military and also by our intelligence agencies, including the CIA and the National Intelligence Council, that climate change has a link to security and state fragility, and I think that we can say with a significant degree of certainty. However, I think we also need to be careful to not make those links too simple. I think a direct link between climate change and terrorism is not clear. It's very indirect. And the way in which the connection might be made is that we've seen some recent evidence, especially over the past 5 years or so, that climate change can, in some cases, given very specific conditions, can make a country much more fragile. And when you have state fragility, terrorist organizations can take advantage of that fragility, as we've seen in Syria and Iraq. And so in that context, yes, climate change could sort of increase the likelihood of state failure and then perhaps increase the likelihood that terrorist organizations will thrive. So I think that's the way to put it. Of course, it's difficult and, with a short soundbite, I think, to make that nuanced kind of case. But I think, and frankly, I think that's what Bernie Sanders said. We don't necessarily have to take Bernie Sanders' word for it. We need only look back to what the military and the intelligence community has been saying since all the way back in 2003 during the beginning of the Bush administration. And then in the latter half of the Bush administration in 2007, 2008, we saw two worldwide threat assessments that the National Intelligence Council puts out demonstrating this link between climate change and security. So it really is an apolitical issue. The security community basically has to look at everything out there and figure out how to mitigate the risks that those things present. And so that's how I'd respond to, mm-hmm. to his comment.
You're probably much more familiar with this than I am. I was reading about this and studying about this issue today. This 2012, I don't know the details of this, study of human conflict from 10,000 BCE, researchers from Princeton, UW-Berkeley, and the National Bureau of Economic Research found looking at all of those many years, as temperatures rise, precipitation becomes more extreme, violence more commonplace, interpersonal violence like rape, murder, and assault going up by 4%, intergroup violence, riots, civil wars, or ethnic conflicts increasing by 14%. What do you make of their research?
Good question. Yeah, I am aware of it, and I think, you know, it's a big sort of meta study, you know, that obviously spans a vast distance of time, and also looks at all different levels of conflict, as you said, from sort of interpersonal violence to major conflict, and I think, you know, from a statistical perspective, I think they found that there was a statistically significant correlation between, dramatic changes in climate and violence. And I think there's some soundness to that research. However, how sort of useful it is in the context of our current political climate internationally and domestically is up for debate. But what I mean by that is that these climatic changes, the effect of climate change on political systems really depends on the strength of those political systems. And so, if a country is fragile in a number of ways, then climate change is likely to make that country more fragile. And so, then that is going to increase the likelihood of violence. And so there are sort of mitigating factors in what we do as governments and societies. On the likelihood of violence happening as a result of climate change, and I think that really doesn't say anything about his research, which is sort of focusing on the likelihood of violence in general across this time and space. But I think when we look at that, we need to say, okay, fine, that's a data point we have. Now let's figure out how we can mitigate any of those kinds of risks. As governments, and so yeah. I mean, I think it's sound research, but we need to do a lot more.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. We're this hour. Certainly, there are big climate talks taking place in Paris as we speak, and just one of the issues they're dealing with is the relationship between climate change and violence. So we are talking about that issue this hour of the program. Our guest has done research on this topic and very interesting research on whether or not climate change was a significant factor in the Syrian civil war, he says it may be one factor among many that deserves careful study, but they had a horrendous drought there, and the period between 2006 and 2011 that preceded the outbreak of the revolt, 60%, he says, of Syria's land experienced one of the worst long-term droughts in modern history, and then you had the mismanagement of the natural resources by Assad, and so you had a displacement of 1.5 million people within Syria, and of course even more now since the violence. 75% of farmers suffered total crop failure. They moved to the city. Farmers lost, in the northeast part of the country, 80% of their livestock, all moving into urban areas. And others from Iraq and Palestine had also moved into Syria. So you had many, many people crowded into small spaces, and economic problems, too, because they had lost their livelihood. Well, here's how you reach our conversation. And we would love to hear from you on this topic. Have we studied this enough? Do you worry about a link between climate change and increased violence, perhaps even a rise in terrorism? Is it something that we need to study? And do we need to plan for it more? We have yet to talk about the refugee crisis. Now you have all those people leaving Syria, so European nations particularly overwhelmed by the number of refugees. What happens when, because of ocean levels going up, there are parts of the world where the water goes up and people can no longer live close to the ocean? What do we do about, and is there a worry about an increased number of refugees? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. Our guest this hour is Francesco Femia. He is co-founder and director of the Center for Climate and Security. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls. We have many of them coming in, and we start with Eric in Endeavor. Hi, Eric.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hey, listen, I just want to bring up a point that the decline in sales of Etch-A-Sketch actually mirrors the decline in violent crime in the United States, which means that causation doesn't necessarily mean, or correlation doesn't necessarily mean causation, and that it isn't a field that can be quantified as right or wrong, except by Monday morning quarterbacks, you know, after things go wrong. And I'd be mentally ill, as well as any guest, to say that they're right, especially using the U.S. government and the CIA as a standard of truth or knowledge.
Francesco.
Yeah, no, I think the caller's right that correlation doesn't always equal causation. And I think that's something that that researchers in this area and any commentators on this connection between climate change and violence you know, need to be very aware of and careful about. And so I think that's a legitimate legitimate concern. And frankly, I think there needs to be a lot more research in this area to sort of tease out the lines of causality between climate change and specific incidences of violence. Our own research has been much more focused on how climate change can place stresses on natural resources, water and food in particular, and how those water and food stresses can drive or contribute to state fragility. And in cases where you have state fragility, obviously, you can have an increase of violence for a number of reasons. And so I think, yeah, I mean, I think we, you know, the lines of causality are difficult to draw. And sometimes we're looking at correlation rather than causality. But I do think, to the second point the caller made about our intelligence and defense community. The intelligence and defense community, when they're analyzing the security landscape, they essentially look at what you know, sort of the best research and sort of the broad consensus on some of that research, whether it's the scientific research on climate change or what have you, when making their decisions. And so when they're doing an analysis, you know, it's usually based on what the best research that's out there. And so I would say that it's definitely worth looking at what, for example, the CIA says on this issue. You know, they use predictive tools, for example, whose results are obviously classified for the most part, you know, that sometimes have an 80% success rate. And so those need to be improved. But we need to sort of take those things seriously. And, of course, understand that there's a certain level of uncertainty about these things as well. But we can't let uncertainty sort of stop action. My favorite quote along these lines comes from General Gordon Sullivan, four-star retired Army general, who says, if we wait for 100% certainty on acting on climate change, you know, then something bad is going to happen. And he, you know, and in the military, if you wait for 100%, 100% certainty, something bad is going to happen, or you're already dead. So I think here we have to be comfortable with the amount of certainty we have about some of these connections, and then, you know, put forward policies that address those risks.
Mm-hmm. We haven't, I don't know if you studied this, but I'm sure you're more than aware of it. It talked about the issue of refugees, what happens, which is very likely to happen, is you have a lot of people living along the oceans in various places all over the world who may not be able to live there sometime during the next 100 years because the sea level will be going up. So this whole issue of where people are going to go, you look at what's happened with Syrian refugees and all the political turmoil that it's caused in Europe and actually in the United States as well, although we don't have many here. Imagine when we have even more refugees.
Yeah, I mean it's a significant concern, and I do, you know, despite the caller's admonition, I point also to an intelligence community assessment from 2011, which was called the Global Water Security ICA, which looking forward 20, 30 years, has shown, you know, raised the alarm about sea level rise and it's in, you know, for example, its intrusion into freshwater sources, particularly along coastlines. And so, you know, there are going to be coastlines that are likely to be uninhabitable in the not-too-distant future. That is certainly going to drive, you know, both internal displacement of peoples, but also potentially refugees. We don't have an international legal regime, for example, to be able to deal with people who are displaced by sea level rise or climate change or these kinds of environmental drivers, and in some cases, like with the Maldives, the entire country, its entire territory might be submerged at some point in the future. And where's that population going to go? How are other nations going to deal with that displacement? Do we have any structures in place to deal with that kind of displacement? So when we look out to 2040 or 2050, it's easy to get very, very worried about these things. But we do have some time now to figure these things out. And I think it's a short window of time. But we do have time to sort of manage these things, both from a mitigation and adaptation perspective.
Let's go to Jerry next in Green Bay. Hi, Jerry.
Hello, Kathleen. Can you hear me?
Yes, Jerry. Go right ahead.
Okay, you're talking about climate change being one of the factors in Syria, but one factor that's hardly ever discussed is peak oil as it's affected Syria. Their oil production peaked in the last, 5 or 10 years, and I've read articles on it, that they are now, instead of a net exporter, they're an importer, so it relates to the natural resource of oil, but that had a lot to do with their problem with their government resources. And how does that, have you had that discussion lately about peak oil's effect on our society?
Yeah, thanks. We haven't looked too deeply into that issue, although we do understand that in addition to significant water stress in Syria, and also agricultural and pastoral devastation, and economic discontent within major cities, there are also problems in terms of fuel supply, and so I think and fuel prices and also food prices, and so yeah, that's a factor there. It's not clear to us how significant of a factor fuel prices within Syria have been or were, rather, before the revolution broke out. It doesn't seem like it was a major contributing factor, but that's an area of research that I think should be fleshed out further, and I think it's a great question.
Hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for your call. Peter in Madison, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if your guest has looked at all at some similarities with historical instances of human-driven environmental changes in agricultural practices on changing food supplies and food security, specifically the late 19th century instances of famine in what is now mostly the third world countries, and whether he sees any similarities between those instances.
Yeah, it's a good question. Sorry, yeah, it's a good question. What I'll say, I think, and this may or may not be what you want to hear, is that the historical record is important to look at, particularly when we're talking about water stress and food stress in the past that has been primarily driven by our agricultural practices, etc. But more and more, when we're looking at climatic changes, and we're looking, especially when we're looking to the future, the historical record is becoming less and less useful. And the reason I say that is that the degree of water stress in the Middle East and North Africa that we're seeing because of climate change is unprecedented. The degree of climate change we're seeing and the rate of climate change is unprecedented. The amount of demographic change in the region, the so-called youth bulge, for example, in the Middle East and North Africa, is also unprecedented. Population changes are unprecedented. So all of these things are coming together, over the past decade or so, and also, you know, as we look at the future and we look at trends in such a way that, you know, that yes, of course, you know, we've looked at past examples in a number of places, including, you know, in the same region. But what we're grappling with right now are some very, unprecedented changes. Now, what that means to us, I think, as researchers, but also as policymakers and as communities, is that, tools, such as, you know, scenario exercises or games, as, you know, the security community sometimes conducts, oftentimes when they're trying to plan for the future, so does the business community and others, they conduct games looking at likely futures, are going to become more and more important as we face these unprecedented risks. And so I'd sort of point, you know, people in the direction of basically what I call informed imagination. You know, we need to look at, you know, our trends, and then be able to, of, you know, sort of imagine a future that's very likely, and then plan for that future. One of our advisory board members, Admiral David Titley, used to be the oceanographer of the Navy, said that one of the major problems we may face in the future, and that we face right now, is a catastrophic failure of imagination. So I think we need to start looking to the future, but of course drawing on lessons from the past. And one main lesson from the past that I would pull out is that water stress, historically, is oftentimes a precipitated cooperation between conflicting parties. And that's sort of a sliver of hope for the future, is that we can sort of try to bring people together around managing their water resources, and there's precedent for that. But if we reach sort of, you know, thresholds of stress that are so acute in the future, that they're unmanageable, then that could break down as well. So, but it is useful to look at the historical record.
Mm-hmm. I believe he said Africa was experiencing unprecedented water stress due to climate change. Can you elaborate?
Well, we've looked mostly at North Africa, but also a little bit at East Africa and also the Sahel. And what's happening is a study in 2011 by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and it's been built on by other studies, showed that from 1970 to 2010, the region has been experiencing some of the worst precipitation decline in the world. And that's mostly in the winter, when the region gets nearly all of its water. Now, in the popular imagination, obviously, and this is true, North Africa is a dry place. There's desert there. It's, you know, that's how people see it. It's getting much, much drier. And that's a huge problem for obvious reasons. It's water. You know, it's an essential resource. And also what's happening at the same time is, a lot of the big groundwater aquifers in the region, are not rechargeable, meaning that they're not recharged by rainwater. And even those that are not going to be recharged as much as they have been in the past due to a decline in rainfall. But that's where the region gets a lot of its fresh water, and the extraction rates are pretty significant. And what's going to happen in North Africa is, if we're not doing things that are big in terms of adaptation and mitigation of climatic changes, more and more water stress on top of existing political turmoil, and that's not a good recipe. The rest of Africa, I think, you know, that we've spent less time on, but obviously Central Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa were already very vulnerable places, very poor places, are also likely to experience rainfall variability. Not necessarily less water in certain places, it might be more, but patterns are changing dramatically. And when you have countries that are already sort of on the cusp of collapse or very poor, then that's going to be very difficult to deal with.
You've also said, we talked about Africa a little bit now, that there are quite a few places around the world, Francesco, where climate change has the potential to make already volatile situations even more volatile. Where else in the world?
Well, I'd like to take a look at a place that's quite different than Syria, and that's the South China Sea. The South China Sea, where, you know, it is bordered by large and small nations, China, Vietnam, Japan, the Philippines, et cetera. And it's warming. The ocean is warming because of climatic change. and fish stocks in the South China Sea are moving northward. Now, that doesn't sound like a big deal. Well, it is for a number of reasons. One, the South China Sea is a heavily contested place. China claims large sections of the sea for itself. Its neighbors contest that. And the United States generally supports some of China's smaller neighbors in their claims. So as fish stocks move northward, countries like Vietnam, who are heavily dependent on those fish stocks, are going to be sending their fishing fleet after those fish. And we've already seen some examples of this. But and as that happens, there's an increased likelihood of conflict, international conflict or tension at the very least, with China. And in that context, the United States will oftentimes respond and have to respond in some way. So the reason I look at this is that we talk a lot about, and it's very important, state failure and vulnerability in places like Syria and in Africa and elsewhere. But there's also a problem between climate change and existing sort of international geostrategic environments like the South China Sea. And I'd point also to the Arctic as well. The Arctic is melting. There's more and more activity in the Arctic. And when you put existing tensions between Russia and the U.S., for example, on top of that, then you have an increased opportunity for international security incidents. And so, there are two things going on. We have new security issues happening because states are failing and likely to fail more often in the future. And then we also have these traditional security dynamics being sort of tested by these changes. And then we have these local issues like fish off the coast of Vietnam potentially becoming a global incident. And so I think we need to look at that. These aren't crazy theories. I mean, these are things that are happening and are things that our security community is very worried about.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about climate change and its contribution, if there is one, to violence, to terrorism in the world. Our guest is Francesco Femmia. He is co-founder and director of the Center for Climate and Security. He leads the center's policy development, analysis, and research programs and facilitates the Forum for Climate Security Dialogue in the national security community here in the United States. He is the author of the seminal report, The Arab Spring and Climate Change. So we'll be with you again in just one moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Lori in Vernon County. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Earlier you referred to the Assad government's promotion of water-intensive agriculture. I'm wondering if your institute or the military institutes have looked at trade policies on countries' abilities to deal with environmental problems, and sometimes or often if the government policies interferes with private investment, the private investment will win over government policies. Do you look at that at all in your work?
Yeah, I was getting a significant distortion on that. I don't know if the question could be repeated or summarized.
Lori, do you want to summarize what you said?
Have you looked at trade policies, the global trade policies, on governments, nation states' ability to deal with their own environmental problems? So, if a government is saying you cannot have these high capacity wells because it affects our local population and the corporate entities are often able to force their way into it and get the water out, mm-hmm. because of the global trade policies, NAFTA and now the TPP. That is, I'm wondering.
Okay. Yeah, I'm still getting the distortion, but I heard something at the beginning about water intensive agriculture in Syria and global trade policies.
Yes.
So I'm going to try to answer what I think was asked, and then hopefully it's interesting.
I'm sure it will be, Francesco.
So, yeah, you're sounding like sort of a distorted C-3PO. I can't fully understand it, but let me just sort of make a comment about about that. So there's sort of a catch 22 in a way in the region. In one corner, you have countries like Syria under Assad, who were heavily investing in local wheat production, and there's that. Then you have in the other corner countries like Egypt, which are one of the top importers of wheat, so heavily dependent on the global food market. Now, when you're dependent on the global food market, as Egypt is, then you are also vulnerable to price spikes. And in that context, climate change can have an effect as well. In 2010, according to Troy Sternberg, who wrote an article in our Arab Spring and Climate Change report that you referenced earlier, 2010, China and Russia and parts of Ukraine experienced a major heat wave slash drought. That led countries like China to purchase a lot of wheat on the global market, and that drove prices of bread within Egypt up about 300% in 2010 and also into 2011. And so while I think the revolution in Egypt was primarily driven by sort of people in urban areas who were concerned about economic issues and political issues, there were also bread protests in a number of rural areas throughout Egypt at the same time, which may have broadened the appeal of revolutionary movement. So that was happening in Syria. I mean, in Egypt. But then in Syria, where a government is investing in local agriculture to try to produce its own food, you have a significant depletion of the water table. So climate change basically makes a lot of options, both options, bad options in a way. And I think that's why it's going to be very important for us to not just mitigate climate change to make sure that things get as back to normal as possible, but that also we try to figure out ways internationally of making investments in places in such a way that will increase their food security, whether they're trying to produce their own food or they're dependent on global markets. We need to make things more stable for countries that are facing these vulnerabilities. And there are a number of things I think we can do in that space, both in terms of development assistance, but also in terms of trade and in terms of economic partnerships. Mm-hmm. Et cetera. So again, I don't know if I answered your question because
I think
I'm getting
did.
This weird distortion, but
can you still,
hopefully
can,
what I said was useful.
Yes, it was very thorough. Can you hear me? Okay. Francesco?
I'm not. I'm getting the distortion on both ends. So, sorry about that.
I'm sorry. Well, if you don't,
I heard you say, can you hear me? But it's, something more complex than that might be hard, but
yeah,
but I'll try to,
okay.
To,
all right, well, let's try this then. We have an email from a listener. Is wheat actually a water-intensive crop? The caller thought that wheat thrived without much water.
Just try repeating it one more time, sorry.
the listener thought that wheat thrived without much water.
Oh, what are there crops that use less water?
Yeah, this person thought wheat did, but you're saying that wheat is, I hope you can hear me, water intensive.
Yes, wheat is water intensive, but there are also, there are other ways of making wheat production less water intensive, which I think the Assad regime was not fully exploring. For example, in a region that's already water stressed and is likely to be more water stressed in the future, irrigation techniques like drip irrigation rather than flood irrigation, where you waste about 60% of the water that you use when you're irrigating, is something that a government in the region facing climatic risks, facing demographic changes, et cetera, should place as its highest priority. And this speaks to, I think, why we need to not absolve governments in the region, particularly the Assad regime, of responsibility, because Syria under Assad is not the poorest country in the world, obviously not the wealthiest country in the world either, but also spends a lot of money on, you know, sort of political objectives that are less sort of vital than these kinds of issues. And so I think, you know, there are technical and technological fixes that exist that can allow countries to continue to produce food in a way that's sustainable, even in the face of climatic changes. But if we don't slow down the rate of climate change, then even those fixes might be insufficient. You know, we obviously have sort of technological developments in desalination that can help. Even countries like Israel have heavily invested in desalination. And so there are a number of things that can be done on the technical side. But I would say that, you know, this is, climate change presents such a significant risk across a whole range of sectors of society that we really need to think harder about, you know, governance changes in general on a national, subnational, national, and international level and regional level that will be able to handle these kinds of changes. So technical fixes aren't going to cut it.
Mm-hmm. The climate talks in Paris, are there big conversations taking place on what we've talked about?
Okay, so I heard you mention the climate talks in Paris.
Yes.
Are they discussing these kinds of issues?
Yes, there? You got it.
Am I right?
Yes, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, I think the climate talks in Paris and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, you know, is obviously a place where some of these issues should be addressed, particularly on the climate adaptation side and, you know, in the climate finance side, if you will, to use the terms they use, but it's going to take a much broader group of institutions, whether it's, you know, institutions like the G7, the 20, the UN Security Council, NATO, ASEAN defense ministers meetings, you know, all these kinds of regional and international organizations need to be paying attention to this set of issues and doing something about it. It's not going to be easily dealt with, I think, in the Paris negotiations or in the UN framework convention in general. I think where it may be discussed is in terms of investments in climate adaptation. And so there are discussions around the so-called Green Climate Fund that was going to be half adaptation, half mitigation for the world's most vulnerable countries. And I think it's worth and there may be some discussion about how do we make investments in places that are fragile already or likely to be fragile in a way that isn't too risk averse, because I think internationally, I mean, countries and international financial institutions, et cetera, are very risk averse, particularly when it comes to fragile countries. But we need to, you know, find a way of being either more comfortable or more bold with those kinds of investments. And I think that might be a subject of discussion in Paris. But again, I'd say that after Paris is really, you know, where we're going to have to grapple with these issues. And I think it's going to take a lot of different institutions looking at this seriously. It's a whole of government, whole of society kind of issue. And it can't be fully dealt with just by these negotiations.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people from all over the world, certainly. Francesco, thank you. I hope you can hear my thanks. Thank you very much, Francesco, for being with us. Francesco Femia, our guest this hour, looking at the issue, is there a relationship between climate change and violence? He is the co-founder and director of the Center for Climate and Security. He leads the center's policy development, analysis, and research programs, and is also facilitating the Forum for Climate Security Dialogue in the national security community here in the United States. He is the author of the seminal report, The Arab Spring and Climate Change. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers from On Air Production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.